And welcome to Bicycle Talk here on WHUS 91.7 FM. I'm introducing you to our wonderful host, Ron Meniza, and I'm Fran Storch, and we'll be here for the next hour talking about bicycles and all things bicycle.
That's great. It's Bicycle Talk, June 8th, 2016. This is a Bicycle Talk show with my co-host, Fran Storch, where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. Lots of things going on in the world of bicycles. There's always lots of things going on in the world of bicycles, especially when it's summer. Oh, I love summer. Summer is great, isn't it, Fran?
It is great, but I think that we should do a shout out to the people in Michigan.
Well, unfortunately, we have a little bit of a somber note here that we have to start. There was a very unfortunate incident that happened yesterday in Kalamazoo. And there are five cyclists. There were actually nine cyclists total that were riding in a group down a road, perfectly straight, wide road with shoulder, everything. And a pickup truck ran into them and killed five of them. So this is it's a sad note. It's kind of a tough way to start a show, but it's also a way to talk a little bit more about this particular issue as it happened. The driver of the pickup truck that hit them, apparently his truck was no longer drivable after hitting them because he did so much damage to it. He then got out of his truck and ran away. So he was caught. That's the good news. The good news is he was caught. The bad news is that there's five people that did not make it through there, and the other four are in the hospital and are not in good shape. They really got hurt badly. So our hearts are out there for the folks in Michigan. We feel very badly for you. As cyclists, we feel this even more so than others do, because we do understand, and we do understand that you're going through a really hard thing right now. So just let you know that we are thinking about you. So let's talk about this just for a minute, because, this is a problem, cars versus bicycles. Well, it's almost always trucks versus bicycles. I hate to generalize on this one, but I don't know what it is. It isn't necessarily, but I can tell you that of all the incidents that I have been near or involved in, or have had friends that have had issues with, it's going to be a truck over a car almost always. Now, we have to look at the fact that 50% of the vehicles, or over 50% of the vehicles sold in this country, are trucks. And yes, I know that sounds like a lot. Not everybody's out driving around a pickup truck, but your SUV is a truck, and your crossover is probably a truck. There's a lot of vehicles out there that are very truck-like, and that's just the way that we are in this country. These vehicles have become very, very large. They are very difficult to drive, because it's very difficult to see where you are in relation to things in the road, like bicycles and pedestrians, and even simple things like grocery carts in parking lots, things like that. The growth of the pickup truck market and truck market in the United States has been very, very difficult for those of us who ride bicycles. And, we own a truck. We have one at home. We have a small van at home that we use occasionally. I think it's a useful vehicle. I think it's very helpful for a lot of people. I know that people that are in the world of construction need them, and it's very important that they have them, but I don't think everyone should be driving a truck. And this is part of the problem. Now, the other part of this problem, obviously, is that there was something wrong with the driver of this particular vehicle. And this particular vehicle, there's a good chance when someone crashes a vehicle and then they run away from the crash, there's a pretty solid chance that they have an alcohol or a drug problem. And they're getting away from the vehicle because if they can escape for a while and get to the point where maybe the police catch up with them 12 hours later or so, they will be sober. And so they cannot be accused of being drunk on the spot because there's no evidence of it. So that is my guess here. The press release today that was stated today from Kalamazoo said that they would have more details in another 24 hours. So by tomorrow, we'll know a little bit more about this. But what a tragedy. Just a terrible, terrible thing. Now, bear in mind, this is a road that is, it's very straight. It's very safe, quote unquote, as far as having shoulders on and all. That's not necessarily the formula. The formula is not necessarily good that we have these straight highways with big shoulders on them. That is not always the safest way to go. It's safer a lot of times to be on roads that are a little more twisty and turny and have obstacles on them known as trees, because the driver who is having problems with their function of driving because they are inebriated or whatever, they're going to have a harder time driving on a road like that without crashing into a tree. So that's a pretty important thing. That's a personal thing. I get on the soapbox a lot about roads with names and not with numbers, but it's just a way, if you want to stay safe, I think it's a better way to be. I know some people that are down in Texas that had a big run-in a number of years ago, and they were on a road that had a shoulder that was wide enough to handle almost two cars, very, very wide, and they were run down by, I'm going to say it again, a pickup truck, another one. Same problem, and this particular driver was being aggressive and was not inebriated, so you just don't know why and what turns people to do what they do. It's really very, very unfortunate. So a little bit of a sad day in cycling as far as that goes. Tough way to start out the show, but let's move forward from that.
Well, before you go, I just wanted to say something.
Sure.
I have Northwestridge Avenue up on the screen here. I'm looking at it.
Yeah.
And it looks like a pretty wide road. Like, I don't know Kalamazoo, but I'm looking at it. It looks like it's kind of from the look of it, it looks like a kind of a major artery. I can see that there's a lot of trees on it, and I can see that there's some fields near it. I'm not sure what kind of road this is. I mean, it looks like it's relatively wide, but I don't know how much of a through road it is. But it does look like kind of like a through road. And here, it seems to, it comes off of, it's an artery off of this business 131. So it's a pretty wide road, and it's near a busy part of town, and there's definitely some state highways that come near it. And it's it does look very long and straight and wide. It's very interesting. So, and then it looks like it goes into the country eventually. I can see why they're on it. It does go through some nice wooded areas. So it makes sense that the Tuesday night ride would have gone on it. It's very interesting. So the thing is, it's like Ron said, there's benefits and detriments to riding on wide state highways. When you're on a state highway, as Ron said, it's very straight. People tend to go very fast. They may or may not have good shoulders. The big problem that you have is that vehicles, there's a lot more traffic on them, and the more traffic you have on them, the more exposure you have to other vehicles. And when you have that kind of exposure, the more exposed you are to cars, the more likely that something is to happen, especially if the cars aren't paying attention and they're going fast. And when you're on a back road, you're going to be more likely to be paying attention. This Northwestridge Avenue, by the way, it's not a state highway. It's but it's near a bunch of state highways.
No, it's not. It's off of 131 or something like that.
It's very long and straight, like you said, and it does look like it goes in and out of the country as well.
But if you actually do a Google Earth look at it, it's a big wide open road.
Oh.
I mean,
it's very really, straight.
Yeah, and very, very straight.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't have any trouble driving your vehicle on that. We have a caller on the phone who he mistakenly is at our house and not up here at the radio station, but that's okay. So anyway, I We will bring him on here in just a moment. He is going to be a guest of ours today. And Tony. So anyway, Fran is going to engineer us on to this. His name is Tony Chirolis, and I hope I said that right.
You did.
Did I get it right? Oh,
yep.
Thanks, Tony. Good. I wasn't sure. So anyway, Tony Chirolis is from Hartford, and he has an organization he works with called BCCO. Is that correct? Did I get that
right?
And
you also pronounced that correctly.
Okay. And BCCO is BICICO. And Tony, tell us a little bit. Well, first of all, I'm going to try to do something a little bit different here with the radio now. Every time I bring a guest on who is a cyclist, because we're also, you know, passionate about our cycling and mad about cycling, I have to ask, what was your first moment that you can remember of being on a bicycle?
First moment being on a bicycle that I can remember is riding on a rattle-canned BMXer with like a duct tape, you know, like foam handlebar guard in my driveway at home. We lived on a rural highway, so we weren't actually allowed to ride out in the street. So we rode on the driveway a lot.
Oh, great, great. And how old were you then, you think?
Oh, my gosh. 7 or 8, maybe.
Okay, not to put you on the spot, but anyway, just kind of so you came from being a kid on a bike, and that's what got you into cycling and into bikes, and now you are very passionate about it, obviously, because we've had some talks before. So tell us about BCCO.
BCCO is a program at the Center for Latino Progress in Hartford. It's on Park Street, which is a busy Latino business district, just south of downtown Hartford. It's a program of a 501c3, so it's a little bit different, actually a whole lot different than what you might consider a standard bike shop. We didn't start that organization with kind of the bike shop model. We started it with a community serving model with youth programs, summer youth employment, and do-it-yourself bicycle repair for members and our equity members and volunteers. And we also have an Earn-A-Bike program that we're running a couple times a year with teens in Hartford.
That sounds really interesting. How does the Earn-A-Bike program work?
Now, the Earn-A-Bike program is not dissimilar from ones that we've seen in other cities at similar, cooperative or membership type bike shops, where the teens kind of sign up for the class. We run it for 8 weeks, 2 nights a week. We do bike education of all different subject matters. The great thing about bikes is they're just magnificent teaching tools, and it's something that youth and young adults are already interested in. So it's something where you can get them Hartford bicycle history with Colonel Albert Pope and the Columbia Bicycle Company. You can teach bicycle science, physics, and engineering, which is kind of my background before I got into this community work. You can teach feminism and cycling, which is kind of awesome. It's not something you would expect to teach with bikes. So,
you have my interest here. Feminism and cycling. Explain.
For the bicycle was a very freeing mechanism and tool for women in the 1890s and early 1900s, where they could now leave the purview of their overseers, male patriarchy, and experience the world either independently or with with friends, and I it brought on bloomers. We get to talk about, the history of women wearing pants.
Oh, my God. Really?
That's Can you great. Say Annie Londonderry?
I haven't yet, but if you want to bring that up, that's a great connection.
Yeah. I'm sitting here with my very favorite feminist and partner, Fran Storch. So she'll go ahead.
So there was this Jewish girl, this Jewish lady, Annie Cohen Kupchovsky. All right?
Okay.
Yeah. And in 1894, which would be right around when my family showed up in New York, my Jewish family showed up
nice
in New York.
New York accent.
Yeah.
Yes, very nice.
She was a young mother of three small children, and she stood before a crowd of 500 friends, family, and suffragists and curious onlookers at the Massachusetts State House. Then, declaring she would circle the world, she climbed onto a 42-pound, which is probably something like that red bike that I had, the Schwinn.
Yeah, something like that, right.
42-pound Columbia bicycle and sailed away like a kite down Beacon Street.
How about that?
15 months later, one New York newspaper called it the most extraordinary journey ever undertaken by a woman. And the trip was reportedly set in motion by a wager that required Annie not only to circle the earth by bicycle in 15 months, but to earn $5,000 en route as well. This was no mere test of a woman's physical endurance and mental fortitude. It is a test of a woman's ability to fend for herself in the world.
How about that? So there's the feminism piece.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Andy Londonderry rocks is to tame a word for this
person. We should probably do a show on her at some point.
Or do an Andy Londonderry day.
I think that would be kind of a fun thing. So, yeah. So Tony, what are you guys doing in your program? Are you doing anything with a women's program?
We are our executive director at the Center for Latino Progress. Danielle Theron is a cyclist as well, sort of how this program came into being. So she is very intent on incorporating women's programs and getting actual equitable representation in Modeshare for women riding. I think nationally it's around 20-25% of bicycle trips are made by women, so they're not equitably represented in bike trips right now. So we at the center, very early on, created the framework for a women's committee, and we're very surprised and pleasantly surprised at how many responses we got. That it took off, from the beginning. It didn't need a whole lot of supports and goading and publicity for it to take off. So we've got weekly, in addition to our Wednesday night and Saturday member do-it-yourself hours, we have Monday night women's do-it-yourself hours that
nice.
Are being staffed primarily by our women volunteers with a little bit of, expert assistance from our staff mechanic.
Well, that's great. So you're teaching basic bike repair, that sort of thing? Are you are you teaching any technique, method of riding or anything like that?
Yeah, we at the women's hour specifically, they were most interested in incorporating, subject matter workshops into the DIY hours in addition to just the basic bike repair. We've been incorporating, workshops on other bike related topics, safety, how to change a tire, how to, bike in the city and carry stuff, how to ride in a skirt.
Yeah, sure.
All of the things that I am not qualified. Some of the things I am definitely not qualified to.
You could ride in a skirt if you had to.
I've heard there's a trick with a penny and a rubber band that looks really well.
Oh, I don't know if we can get into that. This is public radio. So anyway, great. So you have that going too. So you're working with women. You're working with kids, which is great, and very involved in the community. What else can you tell me about your program?
The BCCO program, we've got a couple other little things that we're developing right now. We've got a prototype Bikes for Jobs Access program, which really hasn't been funded yet, but we see the need there. So it's where a shelter or a transitional program refers one of their clients to us, or we self-refer out of one of our job training programs at the center. Which is one of their, their main programs upstairs. And the person needs a bicycle to get, the 5 miles to West Hartford Center for a job because transit doesn't run on the late restaurant shift. So it's for those, low-income workers, a bike increases their job search radius from like 1 mile to 5 to 10 miles. So it's a big deal in a city like Hartford where the unemployment rate, I think around 9% right now, about double the state average.
Yeah, it is.
So we've got that going on. over spring break, we had another prototype program we called Bike Life. In Hartford, students don't, you know, go on large spring break vacations generally with their parents. They're in town, and if there aren't programs, they're, you know, under-engaged. And, you know, not, you don't want under-engaged teens, you know, regardless of where they live. So we created a Bike Life program. Bike Life's kind of a national movement among urban youth cyclists. They're often the boys you see riding wheelies for miles.
Oh, yeah.
So we wanted to reach out to those, that demographic, and put on an event that they would enjoy. And include the bike safety education, which we really think doesn't get to, you know, any teens or youth in Connecticut at this point. There's very few school districts that have integrated bike safety training. I think Simsbury has it, South Windsor has it. Those are the couple of school districts out of, you know, the 100 or so in Connecticut that actually teach people how to ride bicycles safely.
Sure.
So we wanted to do that in Hartford. So we put on a spring break program with safety classes throughout the week. And if a student completed the safety class, they received a used bike, helmet, light, and lock on Saturday in Heaven Skate Park, which is my favorite graffiti and skate park that I know of.
Wow. Wow, that's really cool. Do you do this just once a year, or is this something that you're going to try to do more throughout the year? I mean, education amongst, you know, getting people to understand the whole bike thing is such a it's such an important thing. I have a gym teacher here in one of our Mansfield schools who has been very dedicated to getting kids on bikes and teaching them, and I've donated a bunch of helmets to her to try to help her out, you know, just to, and you know, get her bikes whenever I can find bikes, because it's just so important. I don't think that we as a society are putting our kids on bikes right now, and for various reasons. There's a safety concern, I believe. There's a major electronic concern. I don't even want to get into handheld devices right now because they really frustrate me to no end. But the fact that you guys are doing this this program is great, and we need to do it with more than just the inner city kids. We need to do it to all school kids everywhere. But that's just, I'm on a soapbox again.
I would love to get that curriculum into the Hartford School District, but I think unfortunately Hartford's in quite a budget quagmire right now, and I think we have other ways to deliver the topic to teens in Hartford until we can make a part of that just taught physical education curriculum.
Sure.
You know, with the Bike Life, we do want to do that, you know, every year as a spring break event and grow it, you know, to a size that, you know, really fills out that park. I think this year we gave away 62 bicycles and educated 80 students, and including plus younger siblings, family. We had parents there. We had youth leaders there, from several of the youth organizations. So I was getting the best questions from some of the, you know, the 7-year-old younger siblings and some of the, you know, 30-something youth leaders. So it was really neat to have that multi-generational, you know, environment, which is how the best learning can happen. In order to do that next year, we obviously have to fund it. So since it's a prototype, we'll be chasing grants and stuff. The other thing we're doing in order to kind of keep reaching students is we're partnering with other organizations. Have you heard about the North End Promise Zone in Hartford?
No, I have not.
All right. So it's a federally recognized zone of entrenched poverty. And there is a organization there, Community Solutions, that we're working with. And the Catholic Worker House is also working with them. They do a summer bike repair clinic once a week on Tuesdays. And this year, we're working with them to incorporate, in addition to just repairing the bikes, to put a required education component into that so that the students earn the bike repair by going to a similar class that was similar to what we had for Bike Life. so that we're reaching more students in the city, you know, in different neighborhoods, and working with organizations that are all kind of trying to do the same positive work.
So so they get to actually earn a bike. So if they can't afford a bicycle, then this is a way that they can actually earn a bike.
Yeah, the Bike Life event and the Earn a Bike are the two that we do where they earn an actual bicycle. In this one that we're working with, the Weekly Repair Clinic, they have a bike already. They may have gotten the bike at Bike Life, and it's got something they can't repair themselves or parts that they don't have. So they earn the repair, which you probably know is often as expensive as a new basic bike.
Oh yeah.
So they earn that repair by going to the safety class.
That's great. Now, we really can't talk prices here, but what we can talk about is how are you guys funded? Are you a nonprofit, obviously, and do people donate money to you? Do you get grant money? How does that all work?
It's a mix. The Center for Latino Progress is primarily a grant funded and state, federal, foundation grant funded organization where they run programs based on those grants. So the BCCO program for them is a little bit of an expansion of how that funding model works. The BCCO program has in it built in it, and what we're developing to release this summer is the social enterprise portion, where we'll be having a community bike shop. Hartford hasn't had a bike shop since 2014, when Ray Taskar retired,
right.
which is an amazing situation, considering that 35% of Hartford households don't have a car.
It seems ridiculous that there's no bike shop in Hartford,
but
there is now, right? Because
there will be soon. So we're starting to fill that role a little bit, and just got our sales tax ID and getting that part of the organization organized.
Sure.
And that's going to be one of the income streams to help pay the rent and support the programs that we're doing. We'll of course be going after grants, foundation and program funding, just like a nonprofit would. Bike shops are only marginally profitable to begin with. So when you put those programs in there, you have to have some sort of grant funding to make them work. The other kind of leg of our funding and support model is our membership model, which a member can purchase membership. At right now, it's annual. We'll probably go to a monthly model for those that don't have the full annual available.
Mm-hmm.
And those, we also have a path to membership that is an equity model, where the volunteer puts in 10 hours of volunteering and earns a membership.
Okay.
Which is really useful in our neighborhood, because people often have time, but they don't have the cash on hand.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I know how that works. I know how that works for sure. So when you become a member, what is it that you actually get in return for your membership?
The membership at BCCO gets you access to the do-it-yourself hours, which are at right now, two time slots a week, plus the women's hours on Monday nights. So we've got Monday nights for women's hours, Wednesday nights general hours, and Saturday afternoons for general hours.
Okay.
So it gets you access to those, and then it also gets you a discount on new and used parts once we have the retail up and going.
Okay. All right. Great. Sounds like a great program. Hey, I see that NPR found you. I'm looking here, and I happen to see a looks like they did a little story on you. I was just kind of perusing around here and noticed that. So you're getting some recognition.
It's a great program. It's something we're really excited about. I mean, I'm out here at UConn today because we're making these great connections. Because people are so excited about the model for the program, and it's relatively new to Connecticut. The reason I'm out at UConn today is UConn Stores got in touch with us and noted that, hey, you're doing this urban program with bikes. We're going to have our UConn downtown campus. We'd like to make a connection. We need to do something useful with these bikes.
right.
That students abandon at the end of the semester, where they, you know, lock to a handicap ramp, something of that nature. They have a period of time they hold them, and then those bicycles are just taking up storage space, and they need to do something with it. So that excitement that we love, you know, kind of got us that attention of UConn and made that connection. This afternoon I'll actually be going over to UConn to look over the bikes that were abandoned at the end of this year.
Oh, there's a pile of them out there too. I think they've started to collect them in different places, because I was out on a fitness walk this morning with my class, and it looked like they were collecting them in various places. So you've got a nice little pick of of some interesting bicycles to take care of. And it's funny, because, you know, we're talking about that, and the people that were in my class are going, why would people leave their bikes behind? It's like, well, you know, they're senior, they're moving away, they don't have any way of bringing it back. Obviously, it costs more to fly the bike than it does to buy a new used bike somewhere else. So, because the airlines aren't very kind as far as bike flight goes, they just leave them behind, and they're done. They don't need them back, and that's it. And there you have it.
I think another part of that sort of that decision process is folks have this idea that you graduate out of a bike so that you can buy a car. And I'm going to go get a real job now. I'm not going to be a poor college student. So I riding a bike is below me. And I'd really love, culturally to see that change.
It's changing. It's already changing. The millennials are already making a big change there. I preach about these guys all the time, because guys and girls that are millennials, because I just believe that the future of cycling is in their hands. And they, my son is one of them. So, I've got a pretty close connection here.
When I was coming home from my bike ride today, I saw Graham and young Nick.
Oh, you did? Okay. A couple of youngsters that are around this area that ride. Anyway, you leave your college situation, and then you go on and get a job. If you get a job in a big city, a lot of the millennials are moving into big cities. They're not buying cars. They're using the mass transportation. They're using their bicycles to get around. They're walking. They're using alternative forms of transportation, because the expense of an automobile is, national average is between $8,000 and $9,000 a year. That's a lot of money to put out. You can
Absolutely.
Own quite a little fleet of bicycles for that.
I actually teach that subject matter in my Earn a Bike course. We do an economics and transportation module just to kind of get kids thinking about, how much do things cost? You're going to be making life decisions, and you need to kind of have a concept of how much, the cultural thing that you want to attain costs, so that you can weigh it against other options. So we
Sure.
look at transit, walking, biking, and owning a vehicle. And they're always just floored, how much it actually costs to own a car and operate it.
Yeah, and if you own a car and operate it, and you're in a big city environment, the costs are even higher, because you're paying for parking, and of course you have more of a problem with theft, so you have to deal with that, and your insurance costs are going to be higher because of that. There's just so many reasons why it doesn't make any sense to have a car when you get into that environment. So
yep.
I have a lot of faith in them. I really think that they're the future, because they're opening their eyes to what the Europeans have known for years, that that cars are expensive, and they're not as useful as we have advertised them and marketed them to be here in the U.S. And the car manufacturers are feeling the pinch on that too. They're really trying hard to sell cars right now, because their numbers are way, way down from what they used to be. So
yep.
it's yay bikes. Let's go bikes. This is
yep. I mean, it's the future of our world, and the sustainability is in the hands of those youth. I guess I want to on that, in that direction, I just kind of want to brag about Hartford, and talk about some of the challenges Hartford as an urban city has, and some of the opportunities Hartford has and part of that opportunity is just because they've been so far behind the eight ball for so long that you just see this shining path to the future. Whereas other cities that are a little closer to the cusp on making sustainability decisions aren't quite sure they're making the right decision at the time they make it. So unfortunately, we get to look around at other cities that have sort of made these decisions to move away from a pure car-centric transportation system and what kind of benefits they've seen. So we can go copy a bunch of programs and infrastructure design practices. So where I wanted to go with it was the Hartford zoning that in January, I think, of this year was just passed as a major rewrite, and it included an entire chapter on complete streets and how road designs, what appropriate road designs for the city were, which is a big step away from the, speed and flow designs, that you would see coming out of DOTs and Departments of Public Works, for the last, 40, 50 years. So that change the zoning and the reduction in zoning for parking requirements has sort of like pivoted Hartford, in the direction of those sustainable cities. So in the next 5 years, I can only imagine the neat things that are coming up in Hartford for a city that goes from a city with no bike shop to the city with a transportation philosophy that is radically, radically different and way more forward thinking than a lot of the surrounding suburbs. I just can't wait to see it in 5 years.
Yeah, I think it's really, really exciting. We were obviously both at the Bike Walk Connecticut Summit that happened last Friday. There was a summit at Central Connecticut State University, and it was a bike walk summit and walk audit training, and we had some really cool guests there. But there was a woman from Hartford by the name of Sarah Bronin who spoke.
Yep.
And she's UConn Law School and City of Hartford's Planning and Zoning Commission. I was like thrilled to hear what she has in the plans for Hartford and what Hartford is doing. It's Hartford just seems like it's very, very progressive in this action of getting alternative transportation just completely off the ground and going in a forward direction. And, there are going to be some obstacles to deal with. But the first thing is to make people understand that, it's not all about the cars. It really isn't. There are other ways of doing things, and they're so much more effective and efficient.
Yeah, and it serves the residents of the city more safely and allows them to have a, healthy way to get around as opposed to a daily assault. The suburban, flood of traffic coming into and out of Hartford every day is a dangerous assault on those residents that are, walking, biking, or even taking the bus because they still have to walk, from their bus stop to their final destination. So the how Hartford is set up is almost as like a commuter college campus where everybody drives in the morning and then drives out at 5. They're significantly skewed. And the horrible part about it is it's the opposite for Hartford residents. Most Hartford residents, the majority, work outside of Hartford. And so they have to commute out and come back in with limited transit options. So it's the city is going to find a lot better balance when they move to a sustainable transportation model. And unlike a Boston, or a New York City, where the roads are very constrained, often very narrow. Hartford was such a rich city, such a wealthy city when it was laid out, that the roads are much wider than most northeastern cities.
I didn't realize that.
We have a lot of road width to work with in Hartford, so all we have to do is kind of change the standard for how we use it. And with some basic paint, you're going to get bike lane. And then once the mode share is there, and you're doing protected bikeways and other, bike boulevard type solutions, you've got the room to do it. And the city can totally handle your traffic and do both things.
And Hartford's already started doing that. I noticed when I was in Hartford the last time there's box outs and there's designated lanes and, you know, things to make it so that cyclists have a safe passage through major intersections. I'm starting to see more and more of it happening throughout Hartford. So
yeah, we've got segments of it, and that's how most cities do it, where it's sort of like a repaving project happens and the bike lanes show up. So right now we've got a bunch of orphan bike lanes that aren't connected. The map that's part of that zoning rewrite includes a connected network. So now the Department of Public Works has a network, an aspire to this network that says these are the streets we want to have bike facilities on, so that they don't have to guess. And if somebody like the DOT comes in or MDC comes in with a project and does a mill and repave, the zoning says they have to, go back and look at the zoning code and see what the street type that is desired for a complete street would be. So it's kind of neat because there's all these transportation organizations that don't really talk to each other. The DOT, doesn't necessarily talk to City of Hartford, DPW, and then MDC, which is the water district, ends up doing a lot of contracted paving work when they tear up, sewer lines and water lines. And they don't talk to anybody. So it's one of these things that now that it's written into policy, we have as people who walk and bike, we have an avenue to point at, and a leg to stand on. We say, here's how you're supposed to do it. So it's really neat.
Right. It is. It's great to see. And, other towns out there should be paying attention to this because this is it's also really good for business, and I'm currently trying to work with the City of Willimantic on a project right now because we have this wonderful rail trail, the airline trail, which goes right through the middle of Willimantic, and there was a bridge that was out for many, many years. We just had a ribbon cutting on it this year, just about a month ago, and it now connects basically Pomfret, Connecticut with East Hampton, Connecticut, and it does it by way of Willimantic. Well, Willimantic is the only major city that is in the middle of this entire project, and I'm trying to convince them, and this has been, it's a project, I will say, I'm trying to convince them that by moving the trail up onto Main Street for the 6/10 of a mile that it goes through town and connects from one end to the other end, they will make their city into bike-friendly
absolutely.
City. And this is where the mindset has to change. We've got to be able to figure out how to change people's minds about this whole car-truck thing, because this car-truck thing is getting old. And it will get old, and we will run out of fossil fuel, and we will have problems with the fossil fuels. And so it's time to rethink the way that you're laying out your city. So if you're listening to the show and you're on the Planning and Zoning Commission, or you're looking at the futures of how can I bring commerce into my town, which is clean and very effective, this is the way to do it. Make your city bike friendly, and they will come.
It's a very bikes are great because there's so many different ways that you can argue the positive impact. The most effective way to argue that impact is the bipartisan, multipartisan, is the economic benefit. If you look at the industries that the car industry serves, right? It tends to be, especially in the case of Connecticut, it's a generally extractive industry. When you spend that $9,000 a year on your personal vehicle, a whole lot of that $9,000 leaves the state. We're not Detroit.
Right.
We're not the major car manufacturer. The headquarters are not here. Maybe Connecticut gets some of the insurance funds, right?
So maybe, yeah.
And the fossil fuels are not based in Connecticut, right? So,
right?
So a lot of that is extractive. And then you think about, okay, we're pushing money out of the state. If you took that $9,000 from a car-free commuter or a car-like commuter and you put it into your local economy, just imagine what your Main Street would look like, right?
Oh,
you
my
just,
God, yeah.
You just gave your consumer back $9,000 to spend on local economy.
It's incredible.
And they're going to stay local with it because they're not going to drive to the mall in the next town.
Sure. Even the financing of that car doesn't stay in the state. It's all outside of the state. That's a very interesting point. Hadn't really thought about it that way. Whereas if you're on a sustainable vehicle like a bicycle, that money stays very local.
Yeah, I think Portland's got some numbers on it now, where they add, you know, or they've done bike versus car versus bus versus walk, mm-hmm. you know, for the economic output of individuals over a month in a shopping district, and it tends to be, you know, and it makes sense, right? You've got a consumer who has less, you know, less car expense. They tend to shop more local, and the you know, the bike riders, the transit riders, the walkers, you know, they'll tend to spend more. They'll do more small trips, but overall spend more in a shopping district. So it just sort of makes sense, you know. The Willimantic connection is another one of those, like, don't hide your facility, you know, in the woods when you have a business district that really should be, you know, benefiting from that facility. You know, as a tourist attraction and transportation.
I'm going to bring you with me when I go to the town meeting. Because, you know, it just seems like it's so apparent that you know, you just take a look at it and it makes a lot of sense. And you know, I walked up and down Main Street on Monday and handed out flyers to a number of downtown businesses and said, hey, here's what they're planning on doing, and here's what would make more sense. What do you think? And they were just, I had 100% participation in it. They said, why would they put it back there when we could have it right here? Why would they do this to us? Because mm-hmm. what you're doing is you're taking away from all the small cafes, all the small merchants that are sitting on Main Street, and they would thrive off of having this path going right down through the middle of their town.
Oh,
and the
like
town
that.
Would just become known as the bike-friendly city of Connecticut.
And yeah, if you had it, and if you had the path going downtown, you'd have more businesses coming in.
That's right. That's right. There would
be
future business growth. Real estate values in the downtown area would go up. People would look at moving into downtown as a place to live versus, you know, moving outside of the city. The city could actually grow upon itself. And I'm trying to explain this to them, and it's so hard. And it's all about bicycles. It's such a simple thing. But anyway, yeah. I'm preaching
now,
to the choir
now,
here.
Now, the one thing I did want to, because it was such a beautiful ride to come out here today.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to our world.
Oh, my gosh. I need to get out here more often.
Yes, please. Come on out.
The you know, Connecticut is amazing for recreational bike riding, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
We've got beautiful country roads. The DOT has been investing in rail trail conversion. You know, I plan on going down. I think I'm going to see if I can fit it in and get down to Willimantic and ride those new sections today, and take the Hop River Trail back in.
Oh yeah, you have to. It's great.
So,
it's great.
Yeah,
I can help
done
you
the
out
new
with
sections
that.
Yet.
Yeah, it's really really nice. Yeah.
So those trail sections are beautiful. You know, we should be, you know, shouting this stuff out on a national stage. You know, that we've got all of these, you know, tourist quality trail miles through the most beautiful, beautiful riding country you could imagine, and they're great. But I also look at how our state, you know, makes investments in bicycle facilities, and they don't. One of the issues, you know, is that they don't consider it transportation.
Right.
So when that facility comes near Hartford, it stops, right? So the TT Fast Track has an amazing side path on it from downtown New Britain to Newington Junction. But at, you know, Newington Junction, that terminates. And there's no push to try and find a route for that into, you know, the center of downtown Hartford. So that, you know, that bike facility terminated. The East Coast Greenway, when it comes into Hartford, you know, it's starting, you know, it's almost all the way connected. I'd say the most difficult section of that is going to be connecting it through Hartford. So we, we don't have, you know, that focus on, you know, safe cycling routes in our urban cores where cycling actually is used by a significant portion of the population for transportation.
Right.
And I think that's tied up in a lot of stuff that, you know, Connecticut has as baggage. But I see that tide turning as well. That was part of the Bike Walk Connecticut Annual Summit. I moderated a panel on diversity, inclusion, and equity in terms of active transportation and active transportation advocacy. And I think because those voices aren't, you know, politically represented, and they're not, you know, economically they're not represented, they don't get the attention, you know, because they are using bicycles as transportation. So I'm excited, you know, that Hartford's starting to, you know, move in that direction. I'd like to see, you know, the DOT move in that direction. They've done, you know, years of good work making recreational trails. Admittedly, they serve very few transportation cyclists.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, people like you that are doing the work that you're doing, that this is where it begins. This is, I hate to say begins because, I mean, you've been doing this for a while, but we need to just get the word out. We need to get people paying attention to what is going on out there and what the possibilities are. What a great way to get youth involved. I think it starts at youth. I really do. I think we need to re-educate our children and the next generations coming on that bicycles are a viable means of transportation. And we also need to, unfortunately, you know, these recreation trails, they are as nice as they are. You're right. They don't really serve the purpose of what you really need when you get into a city situation like a Hartford or like a New Britain or like a New Haven, where you need to, you need to have really well-engineered bike routes and paths that people can safely travel on. So
those kind of separated bikeways and paths and bike lanes and paths through parks, those can serve as a really good transportation connection in urban areas. And with the DOT's new religion with complete streets, it's not necessarily consistent, but it's starting to make its way through that organization. That, you know, some really important projects are starting to pick up complete streets. If folks may not be familiar across the state about the I-84 redesign that's going on right now in Hartford and all the public comment sessions and there's a bicycle, pedestrian, and transit committee, and they've been doing public comment sessions in neighborhoods. There are two coming up in Hartford at the Pope Park Recreation Center on the 14th and 15th, and they run them, you know, with an understanding that people have day jobs, you know, and don't have flexible schedules. So it runs from 12 to 8 on both days. It's in the neighborhood. It's on the 15th. It's entirely in Spanish, you know, to recognize that I think 40% plus of Hartford recognizes itself as Latino or Hispanic. So those projects and the I-84 project includes routing considerations in the right of way for the East Coast Greenway through Hartford. And every street they're touching has baked in planned bicycle facilities. You know, bike lanes where they because they're doing a lot of new streets and major reconstruction, and they have the width, they can put bike lanes in, and in some places there'll be separated bikeways. It's something that we're starting to see, and it's something that, you know, folks should kind of take a look at.
It's
going to be a huge change for Hartford, and it's available for public comment right now.
That's great. So these informational meetings are occurring as we speak. Are they coming up soon? What's going on?
Yeah, the next two informational meetings are this month, the 14th and 15th. The 14th is in English, and the 15th is in Spanish, and they're at the Pope Park Recreation Center, named for Colonel Albert Pope.
Right.
The proprietor of the Columbia Bicycle Company.
Columbia Bicycles,
yes. Which everyone should be familiar about.
Yep, sure.
So the place to get the best information about that project is on i84hartford.com.
Okay.
They have the construction information, the options, actual history. They have a very comprehensive history section on I-84 and the construction of the current viaduct through the city, which was kind of a tragic development that bulldozed an existing community of color and split neighborhoods.
I know. It's a big mess. It's a real big mess. Well, you know, I know there's a lot of talk about that redesign. Tony, we're starting to run out of time.
All right.
I would like to let everybody know here that you've been great. It's been really nice to have you on. I am speaking. I just lost my place here. I'm speaking with Tony Chirolis, the founder of the educational bike shop BC Co. in Hartford. Tell us how you can learn more about BC Co. I believe you're on Facebook. Is that correct?
We do have a very active Facebook page for BC Co. That's one place to start. We have BC Co. information underneath the Center for Latino Progress's webpage as well. We're in the middle of creating a kind of standalone webpage because we have so much content of our own with the BC Co. program. So that's ctprf.org.
Okay, and BC Co. is BICICO for those of you who are listening out there and you want to learn more about Anthony's program here, Tony's program, and what he is doing. This is great. It's been great that you came on today. Really appreciate it. We will be talking with you soon, I'm sure. I'd like you to just stay on the line, if you could, please, while we sign off here. So just stay
Absolutely.
On the line, okay?
Have a beautiful day. Get out there and ride.
Well, thank you.
All right, so you've been listening to Bicycle Talk here on 91.7 FM, WHUS Doors. This has been Ron Meniza with his very special guest, Tony Chirolis, today for BC Co. And we will be back with you in 2 weeks for more Bicycle Talk. In the meantime, next week we will have Kat on, and if you would like to listen to us, you can listen to us at whus.org by podcast. Just go into whus.org and scroll down, look for the talk section, and there are sections for both Radio Naturopath and Bicycle Talk. You can also listen to us on iTunes, and we will be back in 2 weeks with more Bicycle Talk here on WHUS 91.7 FM.